Who are we?
Slot machines mimic our mouths. The chances of my discomfort being emitted is multiplied by 3. 3 times the amount of disrespect I feel is felt on you when you enter my airspace. Back off. Leave my mental be. Keep me secluded like land to sea. Only then will you see the disposition that is placed upon me.
Here's an example. We're all from Africa, to be more exact, Egypt or Ham. So when you attack the melanin that is me, you are only attacking yourself. Are you not uncomfortable when you lay friction upon yourself? Don't touch that. Back up, please. Leave me alone. Stop talking. These phrases are the tape that is strapped to my tongue and the speech in my mental. I am the body on the street. Please don't cross the yellow line. It's there for a reason.
To protect the sand in my brain and to refrain you from my mainframe. I have secrets, treasures afar, but what gives you the balls to interrupt the serenity in my utopia? You are crossing my boundaries to the point where you're the enemy. Please get away. Don't get away from me. Get away from yourself. Look in the mirror. Who do you think you are? Well, I can tell you. Papa was
a rolling stone. You are. Laying your head in anyone's business is where you made your home. And the looping opinions and thought where you had no one ears to hear and a mouth to respond. We speak in Braille, but your ADD cannot handle your hasty hands that handle your hierarchy. You have standards, yet you have no laws. Compare us to talismans. We can be worn around a neck or show off at a convention. Whichever is more conventional to us, be your profession. Yet you cross us as if we are in an intersection.
We try to be flexible. We cringe at the unintentional phrases, pinch ourselves when a personal question is brought up, hurt when the person who is talked about taught us we have no defense. Bullets of words and lightsabers of truth penetrate our surroundings. We have no defense. All we have are our boundaries.
Hello, my name is Ruby Jane Anderson, and along with 4 other students, Charles, Brianna, Kabani, and Simone, have collaborated to make this podcast, the common theme being crossing boundaries. First is my podcast, and I interviewed my grandmother about race, gender, and the Episcopal Church.
My name is Jane Waldron Banning. I was born in Painesville, Ohio, on Lake Erie, on April 29, 1938. My father was an Episcopal priest, and we went where a church wanted him. And so we went from Painesville, Ohio to Pittsburgh. And we lived there for years until 1960. No, not 1960. 1955, I think it was somewhere around. And then Papa Kent, my father, accepted a position at a church in Mount Vernon, New York, and that's in the suburbs of New York City. And I was in college when my father moved to New York.
My grandmother is 74 years old. She can recall a time when black students and white students couldn't sit in the same classroom. She was raised in the 1940s and 50s, a time when racial divides in the United States were finally beginning to break.
But it was very segregated.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that?
What can I tell you? Well, it was a little different for me than it was for other people because my father and my mother were very active in civil rights, you know, long before it was the thing to do. So we had there, I think there were maybe 2 black kids in my school.
How many kids in your school?
There weren't that many. There were only 42 in my class.
That's still not that many.
But still, there should have been more. They lived in this one area that was under the Avalon Bridge, and most of them went to school in Ben Avon, but there was very little integration with us. But my mother and father insisted that if we were going to have the Home Avenue gang, the kids from under the bridge could come too. So Lloyd Palm was one of my favorite people in the whole world. And he always came up, and he played softball with us and played our games with us. But Dad was, what did he do? He was the first person to take a black person on a bus in Pittsburgh. And he took black people into restaurants where they weren't supposed to be, and he took them in anyway. And he My mother and dad never, ever believed that there was any difference in people just because of the color of their skin. And that's the way we were raised. And, of course, it was right.
She had a housekeeper, a black woman named Hallie. My grandmother has fond memories of Hallie, and it was through Hallie that she first encountered the racial divide.
But I'll tell you, Hallie was a big influence on us.
Was Hallie black?
Oh, yes, she was, uh-huh. And we never saw her as a black person. I couldn't believe it the first time I went with Dad when he drove Hallie home, and I saw where she lived. And I just assumed she lived in an area like I did, which was a very poor neighborhood. It's really sad to see. But that's where she lived.
My grandmother remembers playing with her friends from her picturesque suburban neighborhood in the summer. She has very fond memories of these days, but there was one thing that stuck out to her.
I'll tell you, it was when Lloyd Palm started coming to play softball with us. And I saw, not everybody in our neighborhood was accepting of him. And there was one family, the father and mother, very, very great, big races. And when Lloyd came up, their children had to go in the house.
Wow.
Now, see, the Bames lived across the street from us, were Jewish. So that kind of helped to make it easier for the transition from Lloyd to come with us. But he's a really neat person. Lloyd, I like you. He was very, very funny. And quite an athlete. And all of us, we didn't make problems. It was just this one family.
My grandmother is very involved in the Episcopal Church, and she traveled all over the world and made many friends of all different races.
A lot of women of all different races.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Alice Nolan, who's such a dear friend, and she was dying, and she was in intensive care. And I really wanted to see her, but only family was allowed. So her husband, Ben, said, "You come, I'll get you in." So I went to the hospital, and Ben took me to the nurse's desk, and he said, "This is my sister, and she wants to see my wife." And they let me see her. And I'm so white, and Ben was so dark-complected. I mean, it was really kind of funny. He said, "Listen, Jane, I have sisters who are as light-skinned as you are." He said, "We're not all the same shade." No, that meant a lot to me, and I got to say goodbye to Alice. And I was one of the first women to serve on the vestry of a church. That was the governing body. And the vestry were the ushers on Sunday mornings at church. And so it was my turn to be an usher, and it was the Sunday that the bishop was coming. So I arrived at the church to usher. And one of the men told me, "Oh, Jane, you don't have to usher today. We have found somebody else." He said, "You can go upstairs and you can serve the tea." Yeah, it really made me mad. But I did it. I did it.
You served the tea?
I served the tea.
Because my grandmother was ranked fairly highly in the Episcopal Church, she did a lot of missionary work in several countries and the United States. She told me about her trip to a Native American reservation for a powwow.
And racism isn't just between black and white. It's all the races.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it firsthand, going on Indian reservations, how horrible their life is. It's really just horrible. And that's in this country.
Yeah.
And that's the people. We stole this land from them.
Yeah.
Okay, I was in Minnesota for this conference, and we went to a powwow that was being held in Mankato, and every year this powwow is held, and the Indians congregate there because that is where the largest mass execution of Indians took place, and it happened because the Indians killed Abraham Lincoln's father. And Abraham Lincoln originally wanted 200 Indians executed. But they brought it down. They bargained with him, so only 32, I think, were executed.
Did these particular Indians have anything to do with his father's death?
I don't think they did. No. This was to show his strength. Don't do that. You don't kill my father. See, that's shocking, isn't it? To think Abraham Lincoln did this.
Yeah, I didn't learn that.
Yeah, I know. And so the Indians were standing in line to be executed. And they were all Christians. Matter of fact, I think they were all Episcopalians. And they were singing this hymn, "Many and great, O Lord, are thy works, da-da-da-da-da-da." And the American soldiers thought that was a war cry. So they sped up the execution and got over it in a big hurry. But they come back every year for this powwow, and I couldn't believe it, that these people could just go around in this big circle. And the men move their feet, da 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 da. They must spend hours doing it. And then all the girls, your age and younger, have on these, they really dressed. He's dressed to kill. He's dressed in love. They look like little aluminum bells all over their dresses. Have you ever seen them?
Yeah.
They all wear them so then you hear them. They process in this power. So that was Mankato. Lots and lots and lots of racism in the world.
This next piece is from Simone McCollum and her friend Amira Page. The interviewee touches on how crossing boundaries results in loss of friendships, school relations, and molding one into a better, stronger, well-prepared person.
To, like, move on with your life. Like, last night, I read this post, and it was, like, this doctor, I forget her name, but she had a glass, and she was, like, how much... Like, do you think this glass weighs? And everyone answered from, like, 8 ounces to, like, 20 ounces. And she's like, well, it depends on how long you hold it. If you hold it for a couple minutes, it feels light. If you hold it for a couple hours, your arm will ache. And if you hold it for, like, a couple weeks or days, your arm will feel numb. And it will be, like, really, like, dumbstruck. And she's like... Well, this glass is, like, your feelings towards other people are, like, negative feelings. Like, at one point, you have to just let them go. Otherwise, they'll become heavier and heavier and they'll burden you. And I thought it was true.
You can have 150 million internal problems. And if you don't say one peep, no one will ever understand. Or even if you do sit there and talk about all your problems to whoever you're closest to, you're never going to fully understand because they're not in your shoes.
I asked Amira if there was a time that she crossed a boundary, and she told me about a time that she was bullying a friend.
Well, we had a group of friends, and there was this African girl named Benatar, and she was mean, too, but, like, my group of friends used to, like, spark, like, confrontations with her, and she would be like cursing us out, and the teacher wouldn't understand because she had like a heavy African accent, so she'd be like using all these curse words. But like my friend Samir, he would like call her like black or whatever, but she like always like sat there and took it until one day where she was like da, 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 like start going off. But usually I would just sit there and laugh with him. Because it was funny, but, I mean, it still is funny today, but I still wouldn't, like, go back there. I would go back and be like, yo, chill. Like, back then, I'd be, like, soft-spoken and, like, don't say much, don't really stand firmly for what I believe in. And, like, now, I'm, like, more outspoken and everything.
There are many effects to crossing boundaries.
Including losing one of the girls I considered my best friend or whatever. So,
it, like, changed me into a whole different person. Now, like, when I see something I don't like, I speak on it, like, right then and there. And I don't beat around the bush. I tell someone, like, if you don't like them, you don't like them. And I don't condone, like, fakeness or anything like that.
What do you think is crossing a boundary?
Maybe, like, striking that string that no one else has really touched before. Alright, so last year in crew practice, this girl named Madison, she's like really arrogant and obnoxious and cocky and everything. But she's still a good person. But she really talks a lot and she always sings. She has like false confidence, I would say. Not like bashing her or anything, but just being truthful. And a lot of girls from the crew team noticed it. And one day while we were spinning for warm-ups, getting ready to go in the water, she was, like, sitting there getting bashed by everyone and everyone, ganging up on her. They were just like, oh, Madison, like, shut up. Like, you're so cocky, blah, 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 blah. And, like, just, like, going in on her. So I stopped. I'm like, all right, guys, like, that's enough. And, like, everybody got quiet. I don't know. I think I put on, like, a firmer voice, maybe. But, like, it was, like, instantaneous. Like I said, be quiet, and they were quiet. I feel like that bull.
I asked Amira about herself to see how that could conflict with what she thought was crossing a boundary.
I'm a strong, strong believer in, like, logic. And some of my friends believe in emotion over logic. And they, like, follow their heart and everything like that. And they know. They're like, oh, like, I don't care what anyone thinks. I believe in my heart that blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, that doesn't make sense. So.
Are you talking about me?
Maybe.
Okay.
So when I try to be loyal, I try to give them the best advice that I can. But I'm also sitting there like, oh my gosh, like, why are you doing this? Because it's not smart. There was a situation, okay, so there were plans for a movie, and the person that I was supposed to go with, they didn't confirm the plans, so I thought we weren't going anymore, so I went out with my family that day, and that person texted me, and I was playing around too much, and I guess I hurt their feelings, and later on I texted them, and things weren't going too well, so we just stopped talking for like a week. And I really wanted to talk to them, not gonna lie, but I was just like, no, because that person's blaming me for what happened, and it wasn't completely my fault. Like, we were both in the wrong. So, I stuck it out and held my head high because I'm not folding.
Crossing a boundary could count as disrespect. Has anybody ever disrespected you?
Not really directly disrespected me, but I felt hostility towards me from this one girl in my class. It was freshman year, and I walked in, and they were talking about One Direction, and they know I like One Direction. They were talking to me, and I made a joke, and everyone's laughing, and then this one girl named Chrissy made a joke, and I started laughing, and the one girl, we'll call her M. So M, she's just like, laughing. Then I start laughing, and she stops, and she glares at me. And I, like, look at her, cock my head, like, what's up? And she didn't do anything. And she, like, rolled her eyes and everything. And then my patience was put to the test last semester, sophomore year, when we have a theology class together, and I got placed, like, sitting right next to her. And I was, like, banging my head to the desk, but we were in theology class, so I'm like, all right, I need Jesus, stay with me, I need to stay strong. And I was just like, all right, gonna put freshman year behind us. And she's like, all right, person, but her voice is really annoying.
What's the most recent time where you felt like somebody crossed your boundary?
This summer when I lost my old best friend. It was just, like, for the longest time, I thought we were, like, the coolest people. Like, we were, like, the same. And then, like, we got to high school. We were supposed to go to the same high school, but, like, that didn't work. So I went to my school. She went to her school. And then we, like, became distant. And she got another friend. And this summer when her other friend wasn't there for her, she expected me to be there. And I'm just like, I am not your, like, plan B. Like, if we're going to be friends, we're going to be friends. And she blamed me for not being there for her or whatever. And I'm like, there for you for what? She's like, oh, like, we only saw each other, like, twice a summer, blah, blah, blah. I'm just like, okay, like, you can make plans with me, too. But this is, I feel like it's all because her other friend was out doing her, and she didn't have anyone to be with, so she decided to come back to me, and I'm just like, I wasn't feeling it. So, then we got into this huge, like, I'm just like, all right, I text her trying to be nice, like, okay, like, blah, 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 like, I think we should just, like, not try to be as close as we are now because you put stress into my life that I don't need and it doesn't make sense. So I'm just like, can you chill? Like, I'm always going to be here for you and I will still love you, blah, blah, blah. But I just feel like you bringing extra stress into my life is not helping anybody, like, either of us. So she just went to this whole thing, and it was just like, I can't believe it's happening. And I'm like, all right, like, it's no need not to believe, like, I'm serious. And she took it as sarcasm. And I'm just like, all right, like, I don't have to explain myself to you, so you take it how you take it. So then we got into this whole big argument. She was saying all this stuff that I never thought would come out of her mouth. And it's just like, wow, like, you really can trust nobody. Like, I thought this girl was, like, my best friend. Like, can't be replaced best friend.
It seems as though people could cross boundaries, whether it's relationship-wise, friendship-wise, school-wise, and etc. What my friend Amira has touched on is how crossing boundaries can make you into a better person, almost, which is something we all need to learn.
Next up, we have Kabani, who interviewed his uncle about love, God, and everything in between.
When you try to seek the truth, you just can't stop on one aspect.
There's always more truth.
Yeah, there's always more to it. Word than meets the eye.
Yo, listen, big word halitosis, multiple scoliosis, Dr. Kill giving the rap dosage, postage, stamp, signed, sealed, delivered, distributed through the hood, motherfucker, what's good, exciting, unorthodox.
I am interviewing Mr. Marcus Alexander, and we're going to talk about, you know, boundaries. How are you doing, Mr. Mark?
Well, I'm fine, Kabani. Nah, I'm good. What's good, man?
All right.
Good thing to break the ice. You know, yeah, it's always good thing to break the ice.
Break the ice, okay. Where did you go to elementary school at?
Elementary school. I went to Spring Garden Elementary School in North Philadelphia.
Did you enjoy your time there?
Yeah, actually, I did. You know, always remember the songs that I used to sing there. I mean, it was pretty live, you know.
What was your most enjoyable memory of school, elementary school?
Watching American Tale in the auditorium.
American Tale.
Yeah.
What is American Tale?
Well, you know, that's with Fievel, the little mouse, the Russian mouse boy that. Yeah. Oh, okay.
You know, besides schooling life, how was your, what was one of your earliest memories that you have of you and your family and being at home?
That would be when I used to celebrate Christmas.
Okay.
I mean, that's always good when you're a kid, you know?
Yeah, it feels good inside.
Yeah, I remember one time me and my brother had walkie-talkies from the last Christmas, you know? So what we would do is probably about like 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning when we know our mom was done. We would try to sneak downstairs because our room was right next to us. So we would have our walkie-talkies. Yeah. And I mean, when we go downstairs, and we would try to guess where the gifts was, you know what I mean, and what type of gifts we had.
Right.
You know what I mean? And we used the walkie-talkies, you know what I mean, as communications and warnings if our mom was coming.
Wow.
That was hot.
That sounds like fun. What's your mother's name?
Charisse. Yeah, her name was Charisse Reynolds.
I heard she's a very loving woman.
She is.
Yes.
Hard at times, but she is. Hard. She was hard when we was growing up, but she's very loving, huh? Strict. Yeah, very strict. Very strict.
What was the worst thing that you did
to get a loving consequence.
Loving? There's no
love consequence.
Oh, let me see. The worst thing that I did as a kid? I guess when I was lying to my mom about me going to school and I would steal food, her Murray's chicken and all that out the refrigerator, out the freezer, take it to my friend's house and we play cards and yeah, we eat the grub and everything. I guess that was one of the worst things that I did, you know? Yeah.
How did she show her affection towards that situation?
She hit me with a two-piece combo. That's how she showed it. That she was a little angry because I was missing school.
Did you have any siblings?
Yes. I have two brothers and two sisters.
Yeah, how was your relationship with them growing up?
Growing up, it was okay. I mean, I was more close to my sister than I was my brother.
Okay.
So, I mean, we had our good times and we had our bad times, you know what I'm saying?
Okay. So, what was one of the bad times you were siblings?
When my sister stepped on my dad going Spider-Man action figure.
And she punched me in your feelings.
Yeah, but did she, man?
Well, you said you and your brother didn't, you know, click as much as you and your sister. Was there a reason why?
Yeah, because he was the older brother and I was the younger brother.
Torture? He tortured you all the time?
Yeah, it wasn't pretty much torture, but it was like, you know, it was that nagging little brother, I guess he would think.
Okay.
You know what I mean? He would want to do things and he would have to watch us because my mom was a single parent.
Okay.
So it's one of those types, you know. He had to be forced to grow up a lot quicker than he, you know, wanted to. And he wanted to do his own thing, but a lot of times he had to watch us. You know what I'm saying? And as a little brother, I admire my brother, so I always wanted to hang around with him. But sometimes that's not a good thing for the bigger brother because he wants to hang around his boys.
Right.
And he can't because he got the little boy with him.
Right. So you said that your mother's a single mother. How did you cope with that? Or were you just naive to it at the time?
I wasn't naive to it. You know what I mean? But I was always taught onto why that I, you know what I mean, that she was a single parent. But, I mean, she did the best that she could. There was nothing I could do with the situation. But as a child, we don't see it that way. So we would like to blame our parents for it. But I didn't see anything, you know what I mean, to blame her for it because
she's trying her
best.
Right, right. And, where was your father during your younger years?
I don't know. All over the map.
Did you ever have a contact with him at all?
No, I don't think I did. You know, I mean, that was one memory, but I mean, I don't know if that was him or not.
Okay.
But right. Yeah.
So, the household that you grew up in, how did that shape you into the man you are today?
I wanted to be everything my father was not. From all the stories that I heard, you know what I mean, and then the absence of him being absent—that was my biggest thing. Now that I have children, you know, and if I ever wanted children, I wouldn't abandon them or leave them like my dad. You know what I mean? I wanted to be everything he was not. Make sure that I don't do the same things that he did. But it shaped me to be a good man. At first, I was a knucklehead. You know what I mean? And then things happened, went to the military, and it was a lot of factors in life, not just my home, that shaped me into the man that I am.
What made you go into the military?
What made me?
Yes.
Oh, because I got kicked out of my stepdad crib house. You know what I mean, down in Virginia, had nowhere to go. I was pretty much pushed, but I didn't see it as that. I mean, that was something that was done in the background, but I was homeless. So I found the military as a way of escape.
When you returned from you said the military to you was an escape. When you returned from the military, did you feel like you were in bondage again, or did you feel like a new man, like a new spirit type thing?
Well, the military has its good and its bad. You know, it made me see that how pretty much precious life is, because I was infantry, so our life expectancy is about like 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to grow up, and it made me grow up. I mean, I attribute that to the military. I mean, so when I got out, I had a plan of going to school, you know what I mean, and trying to make the best, you know what I mean, of myself.
Now today, how do you live today? You're a father, you're a husband, and all that.
Yeah, I'm a father.
Right.
I have 6 kids, beautiful wife. I try to live my life the way God intended it to be.
Okay.
You know, I try to not break the moral laws. I mean, those are the laws that really keep God out of jail and out of trouble. Uh-huh. So I try to walk on that even keel, not too far to the left or to the right. The decisions that I make, I have to make sure that it doesn't affect my children or my family in a negative light.
What is your religion?
Well, I wouldn't put it as a religion. I follow the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob of the ancient Hebrews. That's about it.
You can be classified as a minister. correct?
That is correct.
That's correct. Okay. How far does your knowledge of other religion and people and anything of that category vary? Like how?
Well, I started out as a Christian, if that's what you're asking. Okay. By knowledge base, I started out as a Christian. Went to many different, as they would call it, denominations. You know what I mean? Because there's many different forms of Christianity, but it's all focused on one. They just learn different aspects. So what I try to do is educate myself. I try to learn other people's beliefs as well. Mm-hmm. Like the Quran, the Torah, King James Version Bible, Hinduism, Buddhism. You know, right now I read the Veda.
Okay, podcast ending question. Now, we all, or as far as I know, a lot of people have their own thoughts about heaven and things like that. Like, and my thought of heaven is it's our own personal heavens. Like, mine would be, like, my whole family at, a barbecue, and we're all enjoying ourselves, and, you know, we're acting as one. That's my personal thought. Like, that's how I think it is. What is your thought or how God has made our heaven?
My feeling is I would like to go back to the land that was given to our fathers. That was promised land. You know, Martin Luther King said it best when he said he looked over the top of the mountain and he seen the promised land.
Right.
I mean, so I would like to go back to the land that was given to our forefathers and be at peace, have my lot, you know, and have my family there and worshiping the God whom I serve. You know, but sometimes we can't always get what we want, right?
That's true. That's true.
So,
well, I would like to thank you for taking your time out and helping me with this interview. You shared a lot of knowledge and a lot of things, and thank you.
You're welcome.
We out.
Loud,
quiet. Tommy G. Yeah, what up? Hey, yo, listen. Big word halitosis, multiple scoliosis, Dr. Kill giving the rap dosage, postage, stamp signed, sealed, delivered, distributed through the hood, mother what's good, exciting.
Next is Brianna, who talked to her grandmother about race and racial segregation during the civil rights movement and beyond.
I grew up in North Carolina, in a little town called Spring Hill. I was born there, and I lived there until 1957. That's when I left and came to Pennsylvania. Growing up there, it was all right. Then I had no problem with it. But as I grew older, I got to learn a little bit about how we was treated differently. When we went to the stores, we always had to go in the back and purchase what we had to get. The white people's restaurants couldn't go in the white people's bathroom. We had to work sharecropping, you call it, where we had to work year in and year out in the field. And at the end of the year, we got paid somewhat like $7 a week. And when it comes to the end of the year, when we did all of the work, they would always tell us that we didn't make anything. We used to just get our food on time, and then at the end of the week, when we get paid, in which we were supposed to get paid, they would just say we owe to the store in which we purchased our food, because they'd be like saying that we can't get no money because we owe it to what we got during the week. They earned the money and they would pay us a small amount weekly, like about $7 a week. But they'll say that we didn't have any money because we ate it up all through the year. Mm-hmm. But we didn't eat it up all through the year because it was very limited stuff that we had to eat. And my mom used to work in the white people's house. And they would, like, pay her $3 a week. And then she would have to take care of their children. Then she had to go and prepare their food for the winter, prepare their food for the summer. my mother taken, raised a garden for them, and we'll go out there and we'll pick the food, tomatoes, corn, and all the stuff that she grew out there for them, and we had to go out there and pick it off in the vine and bring it to the house, and we have to pack it up and freeze it for their food for the winter. And my mama also used to cook their food, and when she cooked the food, we wasn't allowed to go and eat to the table with them. We would wait until they finished eating, and they straps that they done picked all over, then they'll tell me and my mom, because I would go there with her because I was the youngest of my family, and we would go and they'll tell us to go and sit on the porch and eat what they had left over. The white people had beautiful houses, beautiful cars. We didn't have no cars. We didn't have no TVs. We didn't have no phone. They had that. But as the years went on, our TV, very small little TV, and we got radio that, you know, you could put into the, run by electric. Mm-hmm. We had irons that we could put in the socket then, but that was like a long, that was like, my mom was working for the Hancock, so I was working for them since she was like 12 years old. I used to go with her up there every day, and they had a daughter and a son, and I used to play with her daughter until her daughter got in school among the other white kids, and they taught her prejudice. She used to drive. She used to get the bicycle. We didn't have no bicycle. She used to get the bicycle and come down to the house every day and get me and take me back over there to her mother and grandparent house. And to one day, after she got in school, and the other white kids started teaching her racial, because at first her parents, they would tell her that don't be prejudiced, because my mom worked for them. They had liked to my mom. Mm-hmm. And one day, she came to get me and brought me back up to where my mom was working for her grandparents, her mother. And she and I was out there playing in front of her mother's store, her grandmother's store. And she called me a nigger. And I got upset about that, because I had heard so much about the white people calling black people niggers. And so I started fighting with her, and I beat her. And she called me nigger again. And I beat her again. And her grandmother came out and told us to stop. And she said, "Why are you fighting? You and my granddaughter fighting? Y'all supposed to be friends. Your mother worked for us, and we love Mary." That was my mother's name. And I said, "She called me a nigger." And she said, "You don't call people nigger." I told her I won't play with her no more. And so her grandmother said, don't feel that way." I said, "I feel that way." I said, "Because I'm not going to play with her no more." It never ended. It just got better. But we had started to get a little bit smarter, and so didn't take all the stuff that we used to take. Mm-hmm. It was around about when I became about 12 or 13, about 12 or maybe 11, all of a sudden it started where we started to ride in the bus, and but they never changed the difference in the school. We still went, the black went to school, the white went to school. But that the people that my mother was working for, they was kind of like all right white peoples. And their son, one of their oldest sons, was driving the bus. And he used to drive past us with all the white kids. And one day he stopped, but he wouldn't pick up the other black kid because my mother worked for his grandparents. And he said, Mary Weatherby, which was my mother, your kids can get on the bus, but he wouldn't let the other kids on the bus. So it was a It was a black preacher in our town, Spring Hill, and he started protesting about that. And they started and from that he was going somewhere, I guess Halifax or wherever. He was like looking into that, and then they started to let the black kids ride the bus, but it still was segregated because we still didn't ride together. My sister and I came to Philadelphia one time. We rode on the trailer way, and we were coming to Philadelphia. And we got on the trailer way. It was me and my sister, we had kind of like tried to get away from that racist stuff. So me and my sister got on the bus, and we sat on the front. And the white guy got his stick and kept hitting in the back of the bus. And we didn't pay him any attention. And he kept right on hitting in the back, in the top of the bus. And so me and my sister said, well, why he hitting the top of the bus like that? And then he got all red in the face, and he said to us, niggas don't ride on the front. Niggas go all the way in the back. So me and my sister got up because we was taught not to fight with nobody. Mm-hmm. So me and my sister got up and went in the back of the bus, but we was like real upset with that because we were wondering why is the white, it was like everything, it was like to stores, to restaurants, to bathroom, anywhere you go. I came to Philadelphia to stay. Mm. Yeah, I came to Philadelphia to stay.
So was it better here when you got here?
Yeah, it was better here, but it was very place that we went to that we noticed it was almost the same thing that was in North Carolina. I always wanted to be a registered nurse. Mm. And I tried to do that after I came to Philadelphia, which I did start in nursing school, but I couldn't afford to pay for the tuitions and stuff, so I had to drop out. So my sister and I did domestic work for a while. Then from that, we had to do that to work up a city reference of what they told us. And after we got our city reference, then I started working like places like nursing home. Then I worked in the hospital. And then from that, raised our kids. We were successful in what we did. We sent our kids to school because I wanted them to have better than I have, so. To be honest, it's the same thing that was going on then, but they're just doing it in a modern way.